Welcome back. It's a Monday, the 4th day of February, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And I guess you'd have to say it's one of those Mondays, because as far as the Waste Stream Press is concerned, of course, there is no story except the Super Bowl. I couldn't help but think as I looked through the news this morning, even the commercials are getting more attention than anything that's really important, from the moves towards World War and invasion to the meltdown. And of course, they'll do just about anything, especially lie, in order to avoid talking about the destruction of the rule of law and the criminals who are doing it. And did you notice? Even the Roman numerals for this year's Super Bowl spell lie. And speaking of which, yeah, we do have to start here. I guess that means Governor Infanticide. Although according to his high school yearbook, a lot of people called him the Coon Man not too long ago. And I'm referring to, sadly, not yet, former governor of Virginia, progressive socialist Democrat and Mr. Ninth Month Plus, Ralph Northam. Although CNN worked hard to convince people he was really a Republican. Because evidently, so far as their fact checkers are concerned, anybody who wears blackface or a KKK mask has to be one of them Big R guys. And that story is kind of funny, since you may have heard at least part of this. Let's start there. It was a big deal on Twitter. The Gateway Pundit, Alex Jones, and all kinds of others picked up on it, including even RT, which had this headline over the weekend. R is for Democrat, they say. CNN labels Virginia Governor Republican in a segment on the infamous KKK photo, which the genuine racist and wannabe baby killer at first fessed up to, because it was, after all, in his medical school yearbook on his own page. But when it got to be more than a bit of a political stink bomb, he did what politicians in general, but the big D's in particular, have pulled out all the stops on lately. If you really have that D behind your name, it's always okay to lie, because the press and, of course, the FBI will cover for you. And Russia Today has now demonstrated again that, yeah, as bad as they may be, they're still way more reliable than most of the American waste stream fake news, and especially the criminally negligent network. Here's how that story begins. A Democrat with a racist past? That fact might be too far from the mainstream line for CNN, so they labeled Virginia Governor Ralph Northam a Republican when reporting on his apology, kinda sorta since withdrawn, for a past racist photo. Northam, it continues, is under pressure from both Democrats and Republicans to resign after admitting, briefly, that he is one of two men that appeared in an old photograph, one in blackface and the other dressed in a KKK robe. He apologized, again, this is a several-day-old story now, for the photo unearthed in a 1984 school yearbook this week, saying it did not reflect the person he is today. No, I think the baby killer concept does better. And he promised to regain the public's trust. Well, not so fast. But he didn't indicate any intention to leave office. No, that only happens to real Republicans. When the story was covered on Anderson Cooper's show on CNN Friday night, the governor's name was labeled with the letter R, which, RT tells its readers, stands for Republican. Evidently, CNN thinks R stands for racist, too, and of course, it's the same thing. The network, it says, which has been in bitter conflict with the duly elected president, Donald Trump, who often refers to the criminally negligent network as fake news, and whom CNN likes to label with both flavors of R, apologized for the mistake after being torched on socialist media, and then later they tried to remove all of the evidence, evidently literally expunging some of the online videos. For those of you that missed this, here's the rest of the story. The photo of Northam was first published by conservative news outlet Big League Politics, but it was soon authenticated by the Virginia Pilot of Norfolk, the state's largest daily newspaper. And now that the old photo has surfaced, several journalists wondered how the waste stream media, and maybe the rest of us can guess, hadn't dug up the image earlier, given all the attention they had dedicated to the Virginia election and Gillespie's campaign, the real R in that race, whom they hated, when it came to doing opposition research. Said Matt Walsh, for example, and the RT story actually quoted it, if you want an idea of how well the media vets Democrat candidates, Ralph Northam supports infanticide and dressed like a Klan member, and we're just now hearing about it. The story does note, though, that Republicans have been forced out of their job for similar gaffes. Just last week, it says, Florida Secretary of State Michael Erdl, Republican, resigned in disgrace after photos of him mocking Hurricane Katrina survivors by wearing blackface and being in drag were posted online. And a Republican county official in Pennsylvania, Carla Maloney, was forced to resign last year due to past socialist media posts in which she compared kneeling NFL players to baboons. But don't forget, folks, if you tweet and Facebook really racist and evil things, you can probably sit on the editorial board of the New York Times. And there are plenty of slots for you in Congress. And I guess we do have to give the president his due on this one. He joined into the fray with a couple of tweets later on Saturday. One of them said, Democrat Governor Ralph Northam of Virginia just stated, I believe that I am not either of the people in that photo. This was just 24 hours after apologizing for appearing in the picture, and after making the most horrible statement on super late-term abortion. Unforgivable, said real Donald Trump. And I do think it's worth pointing out, folks, that he felt compelled to just literally trip all over himself, apologizing for a 30-plus-year-old photo that was before he denied it, but never apologized for infanticide. Instead, when it came to that progressive sacrament, he just doubled down. After all that, the president then added separately, Ed Gillespie, who ran for governor of the great state of Virginia against Ralph Northam, must now be thinking malpractice and dereliction of duty with regard to his opposition research staff, tweeted the president. Although, folks, you know, nowadays if you're a Republican, they may very well take your opposition research staff and Mueller them into prison. Anyway, Trump ended that tweet by noting if they find that terrible picture before the election, he wins by 20 points. And all of this may help explain why the press was so anxious to bring on the Super Bowl on Sunday, even if it ended up being won by a bunch of guys that they previously demonized as MAGA types, meaning the New England Patriots. And the interesting upside on that score, too, is that Tom Brady and maybe most of his teammates will actually end up going when they're invited to the White House. Which brings me, and trust me, it will be very briefly, to the waste stream and even alternative media infatuation with all the big ads on Super Bowl Sunday. The Daily Caller had this summary, the robots have taken over the Super Bowl commercials, noting that if one were to judge solely by the selection of ads for Super Bowl 2019, you could probably assume robot overlords have already taken over. Ad after ad after ad. This was the cutest tweet I saw in their summary. Overheard in literally every ad agency months ago. Any ideas for Super Bowl commercials? Robots. Anything else? Robots. Okay, well, anything besides robots? Robots. Well, there were at least some other options. How about Whoppers from the WAPO? Says Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, the Washington Post blew $5.25 million on a Sunday Super Bowl ad voiced by Tom Hanks in the fourth quarter of Super Bowl LIII. Highlighting the paper's vital role in important reporting. Well, they note, the WAPO has been one of the driving forces in the Russia, Russia, Russia collusion fantasy for the past 2 years. But it's hard to believe $5 million puts much of a dent in Jeff Bezos' credibility gap. And speaking for myself, folks, when I see buzzword bingo and BS slogans like knowing helps us decide, well, you have to ask knowing what, especially if it's not true, and democracy dies in darkness, and I'm thinking, wouldn't it be nice if these guys could actually read, oh, I don't know, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, or even the Federalist Papers, as opposed to Marx, Engels, and Michael Moore? And at least one wag noted, hey, given all the reporters they've been laying off lately, $5 million or so would have probably paid for about 60 jobs. Maybe they ought to change their slogan officially to demagoguery dies in debt. There are other stories, too, hidden within the super smoke on a Monday morning, like this one. President Trump says Zero Hedge has been dropping hints all weekend long that he's about to declare a national emergency. Some would say No, there are other, maybe better ways, we'll get to that in a second, to fund his long-promised border wall after Speaker of the Traders Nancy Pelosi has refused to budge on anything even remotely resembling a compromise or preventing the invasion. With just 11 days to go until stopgap emergency government funding expires and another partial government shutdown begins, Trump has called the negotiations a waste of time and said that people should, quote, listen closely to his State of the Union address on Tuesday. When asked Friday if he's likely to declare a national emergency, Trump said, quote, I think there's a good chance that we'll have to do just that, dropping the hint that, quote, everything's an option. But we will at the same time be building regardless. We're building a wall, and we're building a lot of wall, but I can do it a lot faster the other way. And the implication there seems to be that if Democrats would actually go along and provide funds to repel the invasion rather than to support it, that'd be his first choice. It's also likely, suggest others, that he could simply use the military, issue a direct order, and not even have to declare an emergency. Obviously, Obama and Bush before him got away with it time after time after time, and for pretty trivial stuff, too, especially by comparison, but not so nowadays. So he suggested people tune in on Tuesday saying, quote, well, I'm saying listen closely to the State of the Union. I think you'll find it very exciting. Here's one from Mass Private, also via Zero Hedge, and the most comically communist excuse for a court in the United States, if it wasn't so tragic. I'm talking about the Ninth Circus, of course, on the left coast. Over the weekend, it says, and of course it would be over the weekend and over this weekend in particular, the Ninth Circus Court of Appeals in California ruled that police, such as they are now, don't need a reason to place a person on the suspicious person list. And the ruling, it says, explains how President George W. Bush created those fusion centers whose primary mission was to identify what they call suspicious Americans, and that seems to mean those who were suspicious of them, with cause. In October 2007, it said President George W. Bush issued a national strategy for information sharing concerning terrorism-related information. The strategy created fusion centers that would ensure SARs, or suspicious activity reports, were disseminated to and evaluated by appropriate government authorities and identify requirements to support a unified process for reporting, tracking, and accessing SARs. This nationwide effort to standardize this reporting sharing was called the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative, and it was called a conspiracy theory, too, for quite a while. And obviously, it doesn't apply to the seventh floor of the FBI building. But according to the ruling, Americans can and are being considered suspicious for all kinds of things, from taking pictures of public art to buying a computer or practicing their religion. And obviously, that's especially true if it's one of those politically incorrect religions that has to do with the God of the Bible. The court concluded that being placed on an SAR list, you pee on you, is similar to the process for determining whether a pharmacy is manufacturing drugs, all of which seems to mean that you, your family, or friends or neighbors could all be labeled a suspicious person based on the whims of a DHS officer or local police. No one knows, concludes the piece, what factors law enforcement actually uses in determining whether a person should be put on the SAR list, but what we do know is that the Ninth Circuit rule that law enforcement does not need to have reasonable suspicion in order to do it. Said U.S. Circus Judge Milan Smith, tips and leads to do that required only mere suspicion. And that's an even lower standard than the reasonable suspicion required for criminal intelligence data. Maybe they should call this unreasonable suspicion. The court did say, we will uphold the decision of less than ideal clarity if the agency's path may reasonably be discerned. Good grief, folks. And they note that ISE has consistently pronounced that an ISE SAR need not meet the reasonable suspicion standard in order to expand the base of the information they want to gather. And if you happen to be wondering what ISE might stand for, about the Institute for Suspicion Encouragement. So it says, welcome to America, and yes, folks, needs to be spelled with a K, a nation of paranoid police ready to brand you and your family suspicious for basically any reason they darn well feel like. And if you think about it, that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because we ought to be suspicious of them, which means, well, they're going to put us on the list. And yes, while I don't do this often, let me conclude this story with a bit of prophecy in the form of a question. How long do you think it'll be until they justify we can search your car, your house, or anything else we darn well feel like? Because, well, we put you on the list, and that means you're suspicious, so there you go.
Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe a word I say? We can't go on together with suspicious.
This next story we could almost call a public service announcement. It comes courtesy of PJ Media about that Covington Catholic high school teenager whose lawyer has now released a brutal, as they put it, 14-minute video showcasing the lies of Nathan Phillips and the media. By now it begins, most everybody knows that the Covington Catholic high school boys didn't mob or harass a revered tribal elder, and they put that in quotes this time for sure, at the Lincoln Memorial following the March for Life on January the 18th. The boys were actually targeted and harassed, we now know, although the waste stream still doesn't want to talk about it, by two separate groups of protesters, the Black Hebrew Israelites, who hurled hateful, racist, homophobic slurs at them, and so-called Native American activists from the American Indian Movement, led by tribal elder Nathan Phillips. What we do know, though, is that a nationwide frenzy erupted in the media after the Covington boys were falsely accused of mocking Phillips, spurring hundreds of threats, including death threats, against both the school and the students from across the country by phone, email, and socialist media. Not everyone who helped perpetuate the initial fake story has retracted their claims, much less apologized, and lawyers for the Covington families are working hard to make sure people are actually held accountable. And that's difficult, of course, in Soviet America. But they produced a new 14-minute video of the incident in Washington, D.C. last month, emphasizing the starring role that Phillips took in spreading that fraudulent narrative and the supporting roles the uncritical media took in smearing the innocent kids. The video was released Saturday by L. Lynn Wood, the high-profile attorney retained by the family of Nicholas Sandman, the 16-year-old who smiled at Phillips while that activist banged on a drum and chanted in his face. The initial viral video clip of that confrontation spurred widespread condemnation and death threats against the 16-year-old, and Wood's specialty, it turns out, is bringing, quote, aggressive libel and slander suits against media organizations, say the reports. Here's his comment. 2 weeks ago, the mainstream media, politicians, church officials, commentators, and celebrities rushed to judgment to wrongfully condemn, threaten, disparage, and vilify Nick Sandman based solely on a few seconds of an out-of-context video clip. It takes only 15 minutes to learn the truth, said the attorney in the YouTube description. And it's out there, folks, so take a look. It's worth watching. Item. This story, courtesy of Peter Schiff's commentary, actually came out last week after the Fed's latest two-step. But since we're still dealing with the meltdown and the fallout from all of their obfuscation, it makes sense to put it in here. While some, he begins, may have been confused by Fed Chairman Powell's circular statements in the press conference last week, the takeaway should be abundantly clear. The period of Fed tightening is over. The Fed will now, they say, hold steady on interest rates, and when they move again, they're more likely to lower rates than to raise them. And while the Fed's program of balance sheet reduction is technically at least still underway, Powell made it clear that the program is no longer on automatic pilot, and that the $50 billion or so dollars per month of bond sales will likely diminish and ultimately conclude much earlier than anyone had predicted just a few short weeks ago. So the stunning 180-degree reversal from the Fed's stated policy as recently as December is hard to fathom if you look at the economic data that at least is supposed to guide their decision-making. All of their primary metrics, as well as the geopolitical situation, remain largely unchanged. But what's different is market volatility, can you say meltdown, and financial panic that erupted in December. Markets started to realize just how vulnerable stock, bond, and real estate prices really were to tighter monetary conditions. and as the howls to call off additional tightening got louder, the Fed folded like a cheap card table and gave the markets and the White House what they wanted, a cessation of further tightening. However, continues Peter Schiff, the Austrian economist, by the way, it's my belief that merely taking away the threat of further tightening will not be enough to put any wind back in the sails of either the market or the economy. For that, we'll need to turn and return to outright stimulus. The recovery of the past 10 years, he should have put that in quotes, the recovery, in other words, of the last decade, has been a function of 0% interest rates and quantitative easing, or QE to infinity. Some of us would call it money printing. And clearly, it cannot survive without them. So the great pretense for policy normalization is over. And it'll soon be apparent that we've entered an era of permanent stimulus. And when that understanding finally sinks in, prices of real assets, particularly gold, he says, will surge, and along with them, of course, other monetary metals like silver, and the dollar will fall, or maybe that should have said fail. The Fed may have hoped to walk further down the tightening path before they had to retreat, but their tolerance for pain turned out to be far lower than what they may have hoped. And here he quotes boxer Mike Tyson, who used to say, "Everyone has a game plan until they get punched in the mouth." And somehow this next piece seems particularly apropos today as well. It comes from the propaganda front, and yeah, there was no shortage of electric car propaganda in the PC Bowl last night either. And given that it's still wintertime, maybe this is a good time to catch up on a couple of interesting pieces that, yeah, the politically correct folks don't want you to know. If there's one thing, writes Tyler Durden in Zero Hedge, that electric vehicle owners are beginning to learn, it's that extremely cold temperatures, and we may get more of them, are likely to lead to frustration if they don't take extra special care of their battery-powered vehicles. Ain't it grand, though, that Hollywood types don't have to worry about that? Call it just another added benefit to feeling like, at least, that you're saving the world. As we push through the cold that automakers are using as an excuse for poor sales this winter, customers of some companies, notably Tesla, are starting to realize that things are quite a bit different when it comes to electric vehicles in the wintertime. Hey, you know, come to think of it, at least a good fire will keep you warm. Disgruntled owners of Model 3s have been widespread on socialist media and online forums, talking about numerous issues they've had with cold weather on their vehicles. Not only are their Model 3 door handles freezing up, but they have a lot of issues with battery range draining. A new report by Fortune highlights several Tesla owners pointing out their issues. Quote, "My biggest concern is the cold weather drained my battery. 20 or 25 miles overnight, which is a big deal if you only got 100 or 150 to start with," your host interjects, "and an extra 5 to 10 miles on my drive into work. I paid $60,000 to not drain my battery so quickly," said a New Jersey-based Model 3 owner. The pro-EV lot over at Inside EV stated frankly back in December, quote, "Cold weather demands a long-range battery," before also encouraging people to shell out more money. If you happen to reside in a colder region, or as it turns out, realize you're gonna, and you can afford to spring for the long-range Model 3, then come winter, you'll be glad you made that choice, unquote. Salem Morsey, analyst with Bloomberg, stated, quote, "It's Panasonic that manufactures Tesla's batteries. It's not something specific to Tesla. It happens to Chevy with the Bolt and Nissan with the Leaf, too." And there's more, including some videos that they say inspire hilarity. But when all is said and done, I like their conclusion here. As we, meaning Zero Hedge, stated back in December, we're still waiting for Elon Musk's software update that will stop the cold weather altogether. Meanwhile, Eric Peters, car analyst at Eric Peters Autos, notes that electric cars continue to cost tons of money, contrary to the now forgotten, at least original, point of the exercise, as opposed to Big Brother just wanting to control you, that is, which was allegedly, once upon a time, to find a lower-cost alternative to gas-powered cars. They gave up on cleaner a long time ago, too, because, you know, electricity has to come from somewhere. And furthermore, what do you do with all those dead batteries when they start to pile up in landfills and other places? The inconvenient truth, he continues, is that cheap gas, even with higher taxes, plus government subsidization of high-performance luxury sport cars that happen to be battery-powered, has perverted the incentives for electric car development away from economy and efficiency, which they don't even talk about anymore, to the point where finding something actually cheaper is going to take something spectacular, and battery power ain't it. But the real problem no one's talking about, he says, with regard to this electric, well, cluster something or other, is the recharge stall, or parking lot throughput. Yeah, picture a vast field of electric car recharging stalls while people wait, because in addition to having to wait for your electric turducken to recharge, you'll be waiting in line for the electric turducken ahead of you to recharge. And if you think it's bad when there's just a handful of these boat anchors out there, wait till Big Brother has his way. Maybe, though, that was the real control plan all along. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.